Well, good morning and welcome to the second day of the CPSR conference governing the commons, and especially to those of you who are just joining us today and weren't with us yesterday. My name is Rick Barry. I'm principal of Barry Associates, aka rbarry.com. I'm an information management and technology consultant based in Arlington, nearby here. And I'm also the Mid-Atlantic Director of CPSR and a general helper about this conference and logistician. For those of you not familiar with CPSR, we are a nonprofit public interest group that addresses the benefits and risks to society resulting from the use of technology. Because of the ubiquitousness of the Internet and its potential role in society, the central theme and thrust of CPSR is One Planet, One Net. We see the governance of the Internet as a linchpin within that framework. As clearly the participants in this conference share the same point of view, whatever views you may have on how the Internet should be governed, we welcome your participation here and hope that you will take this opportunity to take advantage of the very special and attractive conference registration fee that we have for only a few extra dollars to get you CPSR membership. We wish to say a particular thanks to the organizations and people who have supported this conference financially. And we're especially grateful to our two major sponsors, the Marino Institute here in Northern Virginia and the Open Society Institute. Are any of those representatives here this morning? I know they were here yesterday. Well, please recognize them when you see them during the breaks and so on. They have a silver star on their name tags. In fact, there's a full listing. There's quite a list of sponsors for this conference on the website and in your program, and we hope that during the breaks you will say a special thank you to those people. Just a few quick logistical notes. Smoking is not permitted in the conference area. Restrooms and telephones are off to the right and down into the lobby area. We will make a plea that we made yesterday, although it was violated more often than not, I think, and that is that you please be courteous to the speakers and to your neighbors by turning off your telephone beepers and other noise-making information appliances now, if you would, please. This whole conference is being audio taped, and therefore we're asking that after each session, those of you who have questions queue up behind the aisle microphones and state your name and affiliation before you proceed with your question or statement. Lunch will be in this room. There will be a kiosk outside this room where you will pick up your lunches. It's on your own, but if you will take a stretch and come back here, we will then proceed with Ralph Nader's keynote presentation right in this room. Now, turning to the first session this morning, We recognize that there is a relationship between current technologies and organizational designs, although these links are too infrequently made and not well made at all when they are. ICANN and other related organizational structures, including NSI, were designed to address the under the assumption that authoritative organizational structure had to match the single root architecture of the technology at the technology level. Our panelists will discuss alternatives to the underlying DNS technology that we've come to know and love, and will challenge the relevance of the current organizational model in the light of other technical alternatives and models. What impact will technological alternatives have on organizational modalities for determining and serving stakeholders, achieving equity and representation in geographical, sector, and other ways, understanding and acting upon changing requirements, dispute resolution, adapting to change, achieving long-term sustainability. Speaking to these alternatives and these issues will be Carl Auerbach, Peter Deutsch, Nico Popp, and Scott Radner. I will not spell out in detail the distinguished credentials of these speakers. Their bios are contained in the program and on the CPSR website at cpsr.org. Let me just very briefly introduce all of them here and together now, and then allow them to make their presentations. Carl Auerbach is affiliated with Individual Domain Name Owners Constituency, IDNO. He is presently a senior research and development engineer at Cisco Systems. He has experience in both the theoretical and practical sides of networking and has been active in the IETF and in the development of internet standards. Peter Deutsch is the creator of the first internet search engine, Archie, and I'm afraid I'm old enough to say that I know what that's all about. He must have been a child.
He's not anymore a child?
Well, he certainly looks too young to be the creator of Archie. He's currently president of ShopHound, Inc., an internet e-commerce startup company, and he's also a member of the Technical Review Committee for the Canadian Mathematical Society. Nico Popp is Chief Technical Officer for Real Names Corporation. He is also a member of CPSR. He led the engineering team that designed and built the first version of Internet Keyword, the system, and he's responsible for its continued enhancements. Nico was director and co-inventor of Web Objects at Next/Apple. Finally, Scott Bradner is senior technical consultant at Harvard University, where he has been involved in the design, operation, and use of data networks since ARPANET days. He is co-director of the transport area in the IETF, is a member of the IESG, and founder of the Harvard Network Device Test Lab. He's also a weekly columnist for Network World and consults in his spare time. So, Carl, if you'll begin.
Hello. Okay. I'm Carl Auerbach, and if you've seen me chuckling up there, I've been just trying to think of some new names of companies, and I've come up with like Mary Shelley Daycare Centers and Big Bang Industries. So, a lot of people think that's a good start. Anyway, I'm with the Boston Working Group and the Individual Domain Name Owners Association, and this cable is not long enough for me to get to the computer at the same time I am speaking. So, can somebody come down and push the button? Okay. Spacebar or the left mouse button. Okay, I'm with the IDNO and the Boston Working Group, and I'm going to talk about a number of mythologies which underlie a lot of the debate. It's my assertion that we are building ICANN on a somewhat shaky foundation because it does not necessarily meet with the true nature of the technology. So next slide. Okay. First of all, we really ought to be building internet governance on an accurate assessment of what the technology is. And we ought not to forget that ICANN is internet governance. No matter what anyone says, it is governance. It is matters of policy. and it will affect a large number of people. If we make mistakes, this policy will be flying with passengers, and it will hurt people on the Internet, so we better do it right. So let's think our way through this really carefully. It's my assertion that we ought to govern fundamental services, yet allow layered-on services to evolve. Because when we impose regulation on governments, we essentially ossify and cause things to stop evolving. So we need to be very careful to leave open those things which do not need some degree of regulation. If we over-regulate, technical stagnation is a significant risk. Next slide. Okay, so the big question to resolve is, what is the fundamental service that the Internet provides? Well, from yesterday's presentation, we saw that it's the end-to-end transport of IP packets. Yet, today, end-to-end transport of IP packets is essentially unregulated function. And nobody's asking it to be regulated. And I don't think it should be. So why do we need to have a regulated domain name system constructed upon an unregulated foundation? Next slide. Okay, a couple of myths about the Internet. A lot of people view the Internet as the same as the World Wide Web. It's not. It's quite a bit different thing. It is a generalized communication vehicle. And a lot of the decisions or perceptions being used to form this debate are based on essentially the point of view of an AOL user sitting in front of a web browser. But the Internet's far more than that. We know that. I mean, I personally work a lot on distribution of entertainment-grade video over the Internet, a rather different application than most people have seen. And in the next few years, IP telephony is probably going to be the dominant use of the Internet. And both of those use the domain name system, but they use it in different ways than most of you are familiar with. It's another myth is that the domain name system is used only for mapping from names to IP addresses. It's used for all kinds of things, whether that be from names to arbitrary character strings. For example, I tend to run a joke zone on the net in which when you do a domain name lookup, what you get back is the text of the Magna Carta. It's a long way from an IP address. It's being used, you can retrieve, for example, on all my submachines, you can receive their latitude and longitude coordinates. That comes right out of DNS, different type of record. There's also records having to do with possibly distribution of public key information. There's a kitchen sink kind of notion of the DNS. It's any sort of, you can almost put any kind of information you want into it, and people are doing it. Another myth is that the Internet will be destabilized if we have multiple routes for the domain name system. And that's what the rest of this presentation is all about. Go ahead. Think of the DNS root system. Now, when I say DNS root, it's the part to the right of the .com. It's the part to the right of the net. It's the part you don't see. It's where you enter the namespace. It's a lot like a portal, whether you go through Yahoo or whatever. It's a lot like an entry point into the naming space. Having multiple routes does not mean that a name will not resolve as one expects. If you're looking up Fred's Barbershop, not that I have a lot of experience with barbershops, but if you're looking up Fred's Barbershop, no matter which way you enter the naming system, you will get an answer that makes sense, that is what you want. And if it's not, you, as a consumer of this service, will move to another root system. Think of the domain name system not as a core service of the Internet, but rather an additional service which can be offered by many providers and which you, as a consumer of Internet services, can select based on other characteristics of that service. And there are other characteristics that root services can offer. Some of those happen to be such as tuning your view of the Internet landscape. If you happen to be a member of a community that has some degree of wants to self-censor what you see on the Internet, an Internet root system can be used to filter out, say, porn sites. DNS routes can be used for also to geographically, or at least with respect to the topology of the network, cause people to make references to servers which are closer to them in the topology of the network. hence cutting down on the overall traffic through the network, which is a gain for everyone. Next slide. Consider that an operator of a DNS route system is much like the operator of a retail store. He wants your business. He wants you to come in and use his services. That operator has what amounts to a shelf, an inventory shelf, a lot like any store. There's a finite amount of shelf space, and people who have products are fighting to put products onto that shelf. In this case, the product is a top-level domain. Whether that top-level domain be .com or .net or .web doesn't really matter. It's the choice of the domain name system, the root operator, to select what top-level domain to put into their inventory based on what they think they can sell. Now, if you think about it for a moment, any store operator is going to carry the most common product. All of the root systems will tend to carry .com, .net, .edu, all the standard country codes. It's when we get to the funny little products, the .biz and .whatevers, where we'll have some root system operators will put products on their shelves and some will not. Okay. There is a risk of fragmentation. There is a risk that I say I use a root system that contains .web. I could send you email containing a URL that says, hey, go look at this thing at blah, 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 dot web. Well, okay. That can happen. And if it gets above a nuisance value, you as the receiver can actually repair it. You can go and say to your DNS operator and say, please start using a root system that includes dot web. Or you as an individual user actually can patch your machine to go use a DNS server that provides that end-level domain or that top-level domain. There is an ex-spammer going into a presumably legitimate business called tldns.com. And what they have set up is some new servers on the net. And they distribute a little Windows application that patches your registry. You could have done this manually by bringing up the control panel. That points you to their DNS servers. And those servers contain some additional top-level domains. And I, for example, run my own root servers, and I happen to point to a completely different root system, which includes .web and a number of other top-level domains. It's fairly easy to switch around from one root system to another. Now, I say that as a techie who operates DNS systems, but it is really not that hard for an end user to do either. Now, why should we believe that fragmentation is actually going to not become a larger problem? Now, I'm asserting, and this is an untested assertion, that DNS root system operators, being in business, are going to make self-interested decisions to remain in business. And to do that, they need to include in their inventory of top-level domains the top-level domains that people expect to be there. If they don't, their customer base is going to grow feet and walk and go to their competitors. This is exactly the same behavior that occurs in the IP routing paradigm with ISPs. ISPs can choose packet routing metrics or what have you that cause packets not to get from one end of the net to the other. However, any ISP that does that on a routine basis is going to lose its customers very quickly because they can't not communicate. Same thing's going to happen in DNS. The operators of other root systems will make self-interested decisions to keep their customers, and that means giving the customers the name resolution services they want. Now, what's going to happen in the end is a lot like the cable TV systems. Every operator is going to try to trump every other operator in terms of including the maximum number of channels or TLDs. The end game in all of that is everyone will contain all of the viable, all of the legitimate top-level domains. There will be edge cases where domains are fought over. Operators will probably tend to avoid those because it will cause their customers to get confused. But it will mean that in the end, after a fairly short period of convergence, that we have multiple routes all containing roughly the same contents. The differences will be at the nuisance level, and the root operators will distinguish their services based on actually value-added services such as filtering your perspective on the net or providing topological location, proximity of your servers, thus cutting down the network traffic, thus allowing the ISPs to be more efficient and offer their services at lower cost or higher profit. Next slide. Let's skip the slide. Okay, as far as reality goes, there is no technical impediment to people starting up their own separate root system. No matter what ICANN may say or do, or the U.S. government may say or do, or any government may say or do, new root systems can arise. And what we have here is ICANN is essentially building a door frame with a nice pretty door and a big doorknob and a big lock on it in the middle of an open field. And pretty soon people are going to realize they don't have to walk through that doorway and pay the toll. That they can just walk around that doorway and avoid it entirely. We ought to recognize that when we're trying to set up a regulatory scheme, because if people can evade the regulatory scheme and obtain a business competitive advantage by, for example, avoiding the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, they will. The cost to set up a root server system is extraordinarily low. Computers are really cheap. You can run these DNS servers on a $500 PC, and they run quite solidly, and they don't go down. The big problem for a root system operator is attracting clients. And that's nothing new. That's advertising. That's marketing. That's the same thing that happens anytime one starts up a new business. Okay, so what are the organizational implications of all of this? One is that ICANN is constructed on an incorrect premise of the domain name system. Furthermore, I'm asserting, and that should be the question discussion, is what the validity of this assertion is, due to the self-regulating nature caused by the competition of root domain system operators, we don't need a regulatory system on top of the domain name system. I would add, however, that we still do need an ICANN-like body over IP address allocation. Next slide. And there's here's places to get more information about multiple routes. I think I'm done. All right.
I had a lot of trouble with hand-eye coordination earlier. Let's see if the coffee's kicked in here. Cool. That's not going on. Huh? Peter Y. Oh, I am still Peter Deutsch, and I am president of a company called Shellhound Inc., an internet startup. There's my email address. Are you going to be running things? No. Okay. So actually, this has been covered a little bit, so I'll go through it fairly quickly. So just to keep the space for the first time. As was mentioned, I'm the creator of the first internet search engine, Archie. You may have heard about it. It was useful for a while. I think it was an interesting experience to have lived through because it allowed me to live through an entire life cycle of an internet technology. It taught me a lot, not just about building a company, which I did, not just about running a service, which I did, but also about how you build things in an internet environment. And that's one of the two ideas I'm going to try to communicate. I'm told that when you give a talk in PowerPoint, you should communicate no more than one idea, at most one idea. I'm going to try to do two here, so bear with me. And one of them is I'm going to talk a little bit about how internet technologies get built and whether you can tell whether it passes the smell test. All of a sudden, there's an echo in here. Okay. If I hold it closer, is that better or worse? All right. So we'll hit again. Some other things that I'm known for. I built the second internet link into Canada. Having lived in Canada for a while, I'm actually originally American, but I've lived in Canada for quite some time. So because I'm now Canadian, I take it at value when I'm told I was only the second, because I'm so polite about it. But the issue there is I worked at various levels of the internet food chain, but someone once said, I was a geek, but I got better. Okay. So I come at it from a geek perspective, but I also have run a company, so I have another perspective too. One more. I am president of a startup, keep going. The main issue, though, that I want to communicate today is I'm coming to you as a user of the internet. Okay? I use this stuff a lot. I use it in my business. I use it in my daily life. I have an 11-year-old daughter who just built a website, and she wants a domain name. Okay? And I look at this and I say, we have to remember that behind all of this activity, there are users. And quite frankly, as a user of the internet, I look at all this debate and I feel right now that that perspective is not actually being adequately taken into account. So in this talk, I'm going to come to you as a user. Okay, next slide. So what do I want? I'm a user and I want something. I'm here to tell you what I want. Okay? I want human-friendly identifiers to reference things on the internet. Note, I didn't say I want a domain name. I didn't want a top-level domain. I really don't care how you do it. I want to be able to refer to things with names that make sense to me. And if people tell me, oh, the domain name system shouldn't have semantic content, I'm going, I don't care from semantics. Remember, I got better. I'm not a geek anymore. I just want to be able to say IBM, and if I'm looking for the computer company, I want to get it. If I'm looking for the itty-bitty music company, I want to get it. Now, sure, it's hard, but if it was easy, everybody would do it. Okay. Now, I want these things to be fast, I want them to be cheap, and I want them to be easy. Okay. That sort of describes me, doesn't it? I'm fast, I'm cheap, and I'm easy. And that's what I want my technologies to be. That's what I want my services to be. Today, DNS is meeting these criteria. I look at all the work being done to put in governance systems. I look at all the work to be done to describe how we're going to get top-level domains. And I say, you're either going to slow it down, you're going to make it more expensive, or you're going to make it harder. And if you do that, you will make me unhappy. And I'm the user. Just keep that in mind. Keep going. Now, our most common tool for doing this today is the domain name system. Okay. So what is DNS? Carl touched on some of these points. We do have a secret cabal that runs the net. We all exchanged mail about this talk before. So you'll see some themes here that I will, you know, sometimes we'll disagree and sometimes we'll reinforce. And this is what I want to reinforce on some of his myths, okay? The DNS is a tool for translating strings of sometimes readable human text into IP addresses, okay? One man's human readable is another man's random ASCII string, but right now, people expect if they use DNS, there's some meaning to what they're doing, and they like that. However, it is not the only such tool. There are other ways to take human-friendly identifiers and turn them into IP addresses, okay? It is not used solely for IP addresses. This is a point that Carl made. Everybody looks at this, and they're talking about all the work about getting top-level domains, et cetera, let's not lose track of what else these tools can be used for. There's the old thing about if you've got a hammer, everything's a nail, right? But you've got this thing here that's actually a Swiss Army pocket knife. Let's remember that it's a Swiss Army pocket knife. It's possible to cut ourselves. It's also possible to undo screws from a box. It is absolutely possible to use the internet without the DNS and vice versa. I had to use the word absolutely because I think there's some myths about the internet that we really have to clear up. It is absolutely possible for anyone who wants to run a DNS server. And you're all going to say, I don't want to run a DNS server. Yes, but others can. And this goes back to the point about, you know, how hard it is to get a top-level domain. Actually, it's trivially easy. I run in my home 3 root systems on my internal home network. Why? Because I can. I have things to do. I'm doing some tests. It's not that hard to do. Okay. So what is the problem here? Remember the old joke? There are no problems. There are only opportunities. So Houston, we have a serious opportunity here. Now, what is that opportunity? Okay. So let's look at the next slide. So what exactly is the opportunity that we're all confronted with today, and why are we all gathering here when we could be at the beach? Okay? Number one, let's do an estimate. Now, I've been doing this now for nigh on 10 or 12 years, and it's really neat. Because you cannot give a talk on the internet without at some point talking about exponential growth. You have to have an exponential chart. Now, I resisted the actual chart this time, but I'm going to show some numbers and talk about exponential growth. Now, how many people are on the internet today? I thought last week, I saw an estimate that it was like 50 or 60 million. I was told this last night that it's actually 100 million. It actually doesn't matter. The one thing about exponential growth, if you're wrong by an order of magnitude, wait a year or two and you're going to be right. Whatever the number is, let's assume that it's 50 million, just because we want to be conservative. Okay? That means within the next 2 years, it's going to be 200 million people. That means everybody on the net today will be a 25% majority 2 years from now. So whatever you do today, bear in mind, 3/4 of the people who are affected by it aren't even here yet. And when they get here, they're not going to care about your traditions and why you did it the way you did it. They want it to do what they want it to do. Okay. Another point. The number of domains registered today. Now, this one, people who do this for a living are probably going to immediately correct me, but I looked around and said, well, how do we figure it out? Well, I went to NSI, and they have a little bubble in one of their home pages that says there are somewhere around 5 million DNS registries, registration entries to their site. I doubled it just in case and said maybe it's 10. But once again, the important number here is if we've got 50 million, 20% take up for DNS names. And let's just use those numbers, okay? And that means that we're going to need 40 million domain names in the next 2 years. And that's assuming that my daughter doesn't skew the numbers, because people like her are going to come into the game, and all of a sudden we're going to get an even bigger take-up. If there's 200 million people, it's not outlandish that even a third of them or half of them are going to want their own domain name. Okay, so what's the problem with that? How many words in an English dictionary? Remember, we want human-friendly identifiers. We want things that people can understand, have some semantic meaning to them. And no matter what language you choose, there's only so many words that have meaning to me. So there is probably an English dictionary with more than 100,000 words in it. Wait a minute, I got 40 million people who want one of these things, and even if I take all the last names and my tax name and all the other things that might have meaning to me, we're talking a few hundred thousand identifiers. Look, we're going to have to figure out how to scale this thing, and quickly. We've got 2 years to get this all done, running, and deployed and paid for. Okay, and I have seen an absolutely serious proposal this week on a mailing list with all this problems with domain names. Let's actually get rid of .com. No more new registrations in .com. Take everything, put it under the country codes. Just make it easy, okay? Except, Maestro, number of countries in the UN, under 200, okay? I'll show you this, okay? So you look at this and you say, well, what's the plan out here? How many entries do I need for country codes if I don't allow more than 200 top-level country codes? And then you look at that 200 million and say, the year after, it's 400 million. And you're going to say, well, at some point it slows down. I'm going, yeah, but not in the next 2 to 3 years, okay? So there's an opportunity here for somebody to look at this and say, 150 million people coming on, 10 bucks a pop, boy, let me get this written down and go find a VC, okay? So everybody out there who's arguing about slowing it down and getting it right, and the organization has to be built, and we are supposed to talk about the organizational implications of this, and what does it mean for ICANN? Well, if you have an organization that in 1 year, I mean, there's been a lot done, I don't try to dispute that, but if at the end of 1 year they haven't added one new top-level domain, then Houston, we have an opportunity here. There's an opportunity for somebody to say, never mind, we're just going to do something else. And I was really interested because I'd actually spoken to somebody from Real Names before yesterday. But, you know, it turns out they're all sort of coming at this from different places and ended up in a very interesting and very similar looking spot, which is that number of people wanting to hand out money for something they want, no more than 100 and some odd or 200 today places I can give it to, and quite frankly, they're not giving me what I want. Let me tell you a story. When my last company was called Bunyip Information Systems, founded in 1992 in Canada. Primarily, the first product was to commercialize the Archie system. And we decided we needed a domain name. At the time, there weren't that many companies on the net. There certainly weren't anybody doing what we were doing. So we said, well, we're good Canadians. A, we're going to go and register in .ca. So I called the guy from .ca, and he wouldn't let me have it. He said, no, you're not a national presence. I think I touched on this yesterday, but I want to reinforce this as a consumer. I was offended. He wouldn't give me bunyip.ca because I didn't have a national presence. He said, you have to have two offices in two different provinces in Canada. At that point, I didn't have a single customer in Canada. I didn't even want customers in Canada. I didn't have enough internet users to make it worth my while. And I wasn't allowed to have it. The guy was so nice. He said, look, I can be your agent in British Columbia, and then you can have it. And I'm going, forget it. You're going to charge me $200 or $300 to give me something I don't want. I'm going to go to .com. And everybody wonders why .com got so popular. It's because it gave me what I wanted when no one else did. And the first person who figures that out and gives it to them better than .com does is going to make a lot of money. And, you know, as a user, I'm not going to object to that. Okay, so what's the big deal here? We can go fairly quickly through this. I hope I don't lose you. For whatever reasons, we have failed to apply the technology, philosophy, and operational procedures needed and used to build the rest of the internet to administering and operating the domain name service. Okay? Or, you're going to say philosophy? Somebody actually said that to me this morning. Philosophy? There's a sort of a philosophy to do this? I thought it was all completely random. Next slide. Well, let's talk a little bit about what it is when you want to build something the internet way. Okay? Any successful internet application must, and I'm saying this as rules. Now, these are empirical rules. You may try it. But so far, those who have fought this have, you know, seen the tide come in whether they like it or not. Number one, you've got to be client-server. It's got to be distributed. What do I mean by that? It means you put everything in one place and try to administer it from one place, you will be swamped. You've got to break it up into pieces and let different people have their authority, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't matter whether you're allocating addresses or you're talking about routers. You spread things out because any one piece of it can go away. The internet is an incredibly reliable thing. At any one point, some part of it is not working, and the rest of us don't care. If our part is working, we're not trying to reach it. So distribute it, client server. If anyone ever comes to you with a business plan and that's not in there, be very suspicious. Number two, you must address a real current need. I've actually seen people try to build technologies and anticipate the future several years out and talk about, we're going to need this in 3, 4, or 5 years, so we're going to put it in now. Be nervous about that. Solve today's problems and fix the things for tomorrow, which means you have to be able to scale rapidly. Okay? If your system cannot have take-up on the order of millions a month, then it hasn't been built properly. Once again, if you haven't distributed it properly, if you haven't done this, that, and the other. Now, next slide. Keep going. Now we're talking about how you deploy it. I've built one of these things, and I want to get it out there and get people to use it. Because I maintain the biggest problem with multiple routes and top-level domains, et cetera, today is nobody's been really creative about deploying a new one. Just go out and do it. And the fact that somebody has tried and failed, as any mathematician will tell you, is not proof that it can't be done. It's only proof that it hasn't been done. It doesn't mean it can't be done if you just market it differently. So if you're going to deploy it, you must work with the installed technology base, which means you don't ask somebody to throw away their browser and run your tool at the expense of what works today. Number two, you must allow partial and incremental deployments. I must be able to put it up and run it in some place and not somewhere else and not break. It mustn't say, well, the guys down in Florida didn't put it up, so that's why it doesn't work. I don't care. Either it works or it doesn't. If it works in my system, I'm happy. Finally, incremental refinement. That's not quite the same as incremental deployment. That means I have to be able to get it up and then go fix pieces of it to make it faster, fix pieces of it to make it better, add things to it later, because I can't get it all done in the first release, because it's got to get out there quickly and it's got to scale. Okay, so we've got some characteristics here of what it is to build something that will be a success on the internet. And my only claim to fame is I have done that at least once. Something got picked up and it had all these characteristics. Okay, now, okay, next slide. So where do we stand today in terms of the debate that we're trying to have today? Next slide, next piece. The DNS technology has those characteristics. It is a DNS. It is an internet-based tool. It is distributed client server. You can deploy it incrementally. You don't have to run it if you don't want to. However, the DNS service does not have these characteristics. And that's why I keep getting this cognitive dissonance. It's not just the coffee. You look at this and say, there's something wrong with this DNS root thing because it doesn't have the characteristics of an internet service. It doesn't have that. Some people can do it, some people can do it a different way, characteristic. Now, you may look at the slide on the wall and say, we need all of this governance structure, we need all of these regulations about giving out top-level domains, we will put everything in lock sync. And I look at that and say, but that, in my experience in the last 12 years, is not going to cut it. It's not going to be something that 200 million people are going to use in the next 2 years. Why not? Well, this is because it requires a single, hierarchical, centralized root administration. And my spell checker tells me that's how you spell hierarchical. I don't believe it. You don't allow just anyone to set up a top-level domain, and you haven't added a significant number of new top-level domains into the root in years. Go back to the two previous slides where I told you what an internet service looks like and say, does that look like an internet service to you? It's centrally controlled, absolutely rigid. Everybody has to agree to a top-level root or it's not going to work. And I look at this and say, you know, it's like when I first heard punk rock, and I looked at it and said, that's nice, but it'll never replace music, right? So we are dealing with something here which maybe, and I used to look at this, and people in the mainframe computing world would say, oh, you guys got to do this, that, and the other, and I said, no. You guys do what you do. I'm going to ignore you because you're not of my culture, okay? I am the Internet Unix user's culture. I want my things to look like this. And you may be right. Darwinian selection will take care of me. But I have a lot of faith in Darwinian selection. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, but just a couple of seconds on how DNS works. Okay. Because again, it goes back to all those myths. We finally got through some bubbles here. The way DNS works is a bunch of people all agree to run some software on their machines, and they agree to put a structure between them. The guy at the top, well, actually several. You see, there's several bubbles. All agree that they will have a file and they'll share it amongst each other. So they all basically serve up the same data. But then they delegate some authority and say, okay, we're going to have a .com entry and you guys are in charge of it. I'm not going to worry about how it goes in there. And a couple of people will run servers and talk to each other. And somebody else will get .orgs. And then that can be delegated further down. These are software, nothing magic about it. You start them on a machine. Most of them, you know, they all run on Unix machines, but they're out there. You can tell NetTorch, but you can go to these machines and issue a query at any time. You don't need anybody's permission. You just send a request to the machine, it'll send you back an answer. Now, the way this works from the client's point of view or the user's point of view, you've got something called a resolver. You basically usually compile this into your software. Any software that wants to use the internet has a piece of code called the resolver library. And in the resolver library are some routines. One of them is called get host by name. You give it the name of a host on the net, you will get back an IP address. It's not magic. What happens is the resolver software has one address that it knows. One place to go and start asking questions. Well, maybe it stores a few for redundancy, but again, all I'm storing is a list of those people that I can go ask questions to. He will then say to me, I don't have the answer, go here. And the next one will say, I don't have the answer, go there. Basically, you will chain your request. From the user's perspective, the client software and the resolver, it only needs to know one place to go. Everything else can then happen if people keep forwarding you on to the next place. It's not magic, it's not rocket science, or if it is, we're all rocket scientists. It's really that simple. Okay, next slide. Now consider this scenario. Supposing I wanted to have .mpeg. I wanted to sell pointers to places on the net that do music. I think I can make money doing this, or I have a religious belief that everybody should play rock music before they go to sleep, or whatever reason I want to do it. I will get the software, I put it up, and I start running it. At that point, I'm on the net, no one can stop me. The only issue is can people find me. Now, if I had a resolver that knew about two routes instead of one, right, and would bring, in effect, the view of the world together, it would work. And actually, there are experiments on the net today and services on the net today that will do just that. Once again, all that's needed is my resolver library needs to know about that one place to go. He and then, in turn, deciding on where what I'm asking for will send me to the right place. Note in this particular model, which you can call the namespace model, does require that you don't have two different kinds of .com with different answers to the question, which is this big fear that we all have about fragmentation. Different people will give you a different answer. In this environment, as long as everybody agrees that I've done .com and you do .mpeg, this works fine. It's been done. There's no reason why somebody can't make a business out of this once they figure out how to get people to point to it. And as Carl pointed out, that's a marketing problem. Now, he says it's a merging of multiple routes into a single entity. As long as there are no naming collisions, that is to say, no two people that want to have the same name to do different things, this works fine today. There are examples live in service, and the net did not grind to a halt. Nothing broke. The rest of us just smiled. Okay. Now consider a different solution. This is a different scenario. There are two routes. Two completely different standalone systems. Two .coms. And note, those two .coms resolve to different addresses. Okay. Shophound.com in the yellow system is not the same as Shophound.com in the red system. My God, we fragmented the net. Oh. As long as my resolver and my client can understand that that's the world I live in, where is the problem? And I've had people tell me, users won't understand this. Users cannot understand this. Well, imagine if 1928, or whatever the number was when we did it, and we ran out of phone numbers. It wasn't possible to give everybody in the world who hooked up to the phone system a unique number anymore. Did we give up? Did we require them to take longer and longer strings? Well, in effect, we fragmented the system into distinct regions. We have these area codes to tell us which region we actually want to go to. And now all of a sudden, you can have as many examples of the same number or the same identifier as you want. It's funny how what you do store in your brain and what you don't. I have, for example, all the words to the Gilligan's Island theme song up here. Okay. I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but I remember that. And one thing I remember is my phone number from when I was 11 years old, 983-4571. It was an address, a number in California. I was up in Montreal before I got on the plane. I dialed the number. I got somebody's cell phone in Montreal. The world is used to the concept that more than one place can be reached with the same identifier. All we need is the conceptual link that says, in this context, this is the right thing to do. That is, again, a marketing problem. It is not a technology problem. Okay? What is this beast? This is, as I said, a concept very familiar to anyone who's had to use the telephone. It's area code. Now, is there any problem with this technically? No. Is there a problem politically? Quite possibly. I am sure the people who are working on the current system who are so afraid of fragmentation will say, this won't work, politically or culturally or whatever. And they may be right. The only thing I argue is, why not try it? If somebody tries it and makes a lot of money, he was right. And he tried it and you didn't make a lot of money, he was wrong. Technically, you will not break the net if you try to do this. Some people will try it, and it doesn't work, they'll stop using it. That's all that's going to happen. Nothing will break. So how does this particular concept work? I think I've covered this fairly quickly, but it works quite nicely. As an experiment, as I've said a couple of times in the last day or two, I have set up and run three root systems in my house on three different machines. And I've got software that lets me decide which one I want to go to by telling it, go to area code 514 and look up this IP address. And it works. It's one line of code in the resolver library to make this work. I was actually going to show the line of code, but I figured that would be too pretentious. But believe me, you can make this work using today's software with one line of code sitting on top of it. All you do is you change the resolver that you start with, and you're done. I ran the test, okay? Now, for each collection of resolvers, you've got to be able to tell the client resolver library where to go. But that is the only challenge, and so it's not a technical problem. It really is a cultural and marketing one. Okay, now the question is, how do I put it on the side of a bus? Okay, I need some way to do this. Well, there's a little thing that's been going on at the IETF for a number of years, a sort of a follow-on and spin-off to the URL work. The URL of these infamous great gobbing strings that we all have to type in now. They are basically addresses. A URL says, here's a protocol, here's a protocol, and here's some data, go get this thing. Well, a group of people decided it'd be nice to have a uniform resource name, which is not tied to any location or protocol. And the specifications of that have now been built. Okay, they look something like this. I could say zone and a number and then a URL. That's a valid example of a URN. Now, that you can put on the side of a bus. Okay? The standards are there. People have written library plugins that go into Netscape and Explorer. The ISBN people love these things because they want to say ISBN number. Tell me where the book is. So they have actually written plugins that you can use today to go find things. So that's not a technological problem. Okay? for example, that I want to zone number, number, number. So I need somebody I can go to and say, give me the next available number. But if you look over on the wall, this is a service that was done by two people part-time. We don't need a government structure to say, give me the next number. Okay, and just, I'm almost done here. Now consider that we don't use DNS at all. I want human-friendly names. I don't care who gives them to me. Are there any other possibilities on the horizon? For example, without going into details, we can look around and say, all I want is somebody given a human-friendly string to give me an IP address. And what are the possible choices I might mention? These include real names. I didn't know he was going to be here when I wrote that one. Web-based search engines. I go to AltaVista. I give it a string. I get back a link. I follow the link. Proxy services. I have this thing. I don't know where it is. I send it off to a proxy that knows about five resolvers. It finds the right one. Or it tells me I have a collision. Proxies work today in our web browsers. We can certainly imagine mail forwarding services that receive a piece of mail and rewrite it. There's a service there waiting to be built by somebody. Okay? Technically, there's no scarcity in domain names. That's the implications of all of this. There's no reason that you can't run .web and I can't run .web, with one exception. I absolutely believe that if Chris Ambler has a valid claim to .web as a trademark, he should be able to defend that. And I would certainly respect any trademark built up like that. Because I talked to Chris, and I don't want to misrepresent his position, but as I understand it yesterday, he said he really doesn't care about the underlying transport technology. He's trying to build a brand. And I look at that and say, and that's exactly the right attitude. If he wants to build .web and can deliver lots of ways to put that up on the side of the bus, I would encourage him to do so. But in terms of saying there's a scarcity and we've got to control and we've got to limit, I go back to what makes a good internet service and say, you try that for much longer, you're going to be irrelevant. Okay, consequences of all of this. Organizations and individuals have far more choices than they realize. We can, as consumers, say, darn it, I want domain names to be $12 so my daughter can have one. I want this one because that's the one her rock band has decided as their name. And if you don't give it to me, I'm going to give the money to somebody else. Okay? Consequences for somebody like ICANN? There, as Carl said, there is a role for an organization that coordinates. Okay? Now, you can build all this governance structure, but you'll have nothing to govern. Because if you try to pass a law and you try to force me or you try to charge me money for something that I don't think is worth the amount of money you're charging me, I will simply route around you. We've been saying this for years on the internet. Network failure of any sort, censorship or anything else, is network failure, and we're going to route around it. And my own particular feeling about this particular debate, having followed it for 2 years, is this is an organizational issue that's very rapidly on its way to being routed around. Okay? The market is about to reach 200 million people. That's a very big number. There's a saying that at one point, a difference in degree becomes a difference in kind. I have seen this happen on the internet several times. When you went from 100,000 to a million, it was a fundamental change. You could suddenly run a company on this. And when it went from 1 million to 10 million, people got attracted who weren't attracted before. At 200 million, you're getting the attention of people who wouldn't have done it before, and they're going to do things they wouldn't have done even last year. Just keep that in mind, okay? User demand in the free market is about to overwhelm this debate. There's the old joke of the 1830s, the Paris mob rose up. They tend to do that on hot days, okay? And they want to go burn something down, and they're running down. So this guy's standing there, and he sees the Paris mob come sweeping up the street, with their pitchforks and their burning brands, and they go sweeping by. And at some point, this little guy runs up behind them and says, which way did they go? He said, they went that way. Why? I'm their leader. And he runs off. And for everyone participating in this debate, bear in mind that that's the situation from the user's perspective that we're seeing. A lot of people are arguing about whether we allow one more or two more or five more top-level domains and when. And I'm looking at that and saying, 200 million people, folks, and half of them are going to want a domain name. Okay? I suspect we're at that point today, if not tomorrow. Okay, lead, follow, or get out of the way. As a user, that's my advice to everyone involved in this debate. Stop taking yourself so seriously. Someone talk about the consent of the governed. I've heard that a lot in the last 2 years. Now, I actually think this is not about the consent of the governed. It's the tolerance of the users. Don't hurt me. Don't cost me money. As long as these things resolve, I won't care what you do. But break it, and you will have the wrath of God of 200 million people down on you. So, final point. Anyone can deploy such a situation or such a system today. The software is out there. If the guys who run Bind suddenly say, I've changed the rules, you can't use Bind, you go down to Australia and pick up something called Vince. There are lots of choices for technology to make this happen. The success of such a system will be entirely a matter of market building and branding. It is not a question of policy building. It's not a question of whether we get the right set of dispute resolution policies. Because if your dispute resolution policy is not the one that I as a user am going to want. I'm going to walk down the street and go into the next store. And finally, you ignore what users want. You have only yourselves to blame if the market moves on without you. And as I said, I come at this entirely as a consumer. I'm not trying to run a registry. I don't want a registry. I just want registries out there. I have a company. I want to register 5 or 10 top-level domains. I want to do it in the next 3 to 6 months. And is there anybody here see a reason why I can't do that and says, I can't do it, then I'm going to say, okay, so you're not going to get my check. As a user, that's all that matters to me. And I think we should take that. Hopefully you'll take that as sort of a, it sounds arrogant, but I'm a user in a free market economy. I'm allowed to be arrogant. Give me what I want, or I'm going to give the money to somebody else. Okay, I'm going to stop at that point and hand it over to the next speaker. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Nico Todd from Real Name. I'll start thanking Peter for the nice plug. Believe me, it was not really yours. So what I want to do here is I want to talk about human-friendly naming and compare it versus DNS naming. The goal of this presentation is really to introduce to you some new technologies, which I believe has the potential to become the dominant way as we users we will navigate the web within 2 to 3 years. And this is significant because in the context of this discussion, if the prophecy is true, it means a lot. I mean, first it means that DNS names, as we know them, will be replaced. And by replaced, I really mean replaced from a user perspective. That doesn't mean they actually go away. And also, if we have the ability to build a new naming structure, I think it gives us the opportunity to address some of the shortfalls of the prior systems. Like, you know, it's always better the second time. And now, this new technology also, I believe, gives us, and I'll speak to that in a second, gives us some degrees of freedom that did not exist in the prior technology. And I think we can exploit these degrees of freedom to think of the organization and the management of the namespace in a different way. Now, before I get started, I want to make something clear because I use words such as replacing DNS. What I want to make really crystal clear is that DNS is not going anywhere. From a technical standpoint, DNS is really anchored, and we heard it within the internet infrastructure today. We heard that. Now, DNS, as a matter of fact, there is not a single significant protocol which is not using DNS, whether it's the mail protocol, the address transfer protocol for the web, you know, the wireless access protocol, the fast transfer protocol. So DNS is here. What I'm talking about is to actually hide a level of naming, a new layer, like we always do in software with the layers like the onions on top, you know, on top of each other, that will actually bring DNS a level down. And that way, that layer will shield the user from some of the intricacies and some of the limitations of DNS. And that's what I'm going to talk about. So just to give you a roadmap of the presentation, there are really three parts. The first part is mostly education. I'd like to explain to you how the keyword system works, not from a technical standpoint, but mostly from the context of use, from the user standpoint. Then I'll benchmark, if you want, the keywords as web addresses versus the DNS-based addresses, the URL, or the URI, to use a more technical term. And third, what I want to do is take a look at the implication of that technology from a policy and organization standpoint. I'd like to open it for debate, so I figured that one way to approach that one for me would be to present some of the things we've done in the context of Real Name, because I think they're radically different in terms of policy from what the domain name system does today. And also the consequences of these policies on our organization, how we structure ourselves. And I think it will open the debate. So let's start with the context of use. Keyword systems, primarily, the way we envision them, is they would be used in the context of pure navigation. And the primary, the most natural user interface for navigation is the address bar of the browser. This is the place where you type URLs today. So this is Internet Explorer 5. And, you know, actually today, if you're using Internet Explorer 5, you can type a keyword, something like Sony Vaio, and what will happen, you will directly go to the page from Sony that talks about the Vaio, displayed in their website, by default without any plugins. And on the left-hand side, you have a list of related results, similar to the type of results a search engine will give you. And that's IE5 today. IE5 is 33% of market share. We're also working with Microsoft to enable IE4. Projections say that two together, within 6 months, they expect to have a reach of 70% of users. So, and here the proposition again is easy to understand, is these keywords are easier to type to navigate than a URL would be. Now there's a second type of use that actually mostly confuses the issue, is that these keyword systems are often integrated within search engines. And in a search engine, the value proposition is that they are perceived as an enhancement to search. What happens is that the number of web pages on the web grew significantly, almost 800 million, almost a billion. Search engine like AltaVista here, you have Infosys, typically indexes 200 million of web pages. They are based on the text within the web page, so they've lost a lot of the accuracy. So if you type something like Sony Handicam or Sony Value on the search engine, you will actually find a lot of pages that talk about that product that you will not find the page from Sony unless you're ready to spend 20 minutes. So again, by displaying the keyword, the official web address, if you want, as the first search result, it enhances the search by including the precision. So these are the two most common use of keywords for navigation. Now, let's move now in the second part of the presentation, which is understanding how these addresses compare both from a user standpoint and a brand holder standpoint. From a user standpoint, it's all about simplicity. A little marketing slide here, but basically this is the web page on that call, and you can see at the top the URL for that page, on the right hand side the keyword on that call, and the question is, which one is the simplest address. So it's fairly obvious. The keyword is better in that context because it has no syntax. URLs have syntax. You have to understand, the HTTP colon and other browsers have done a good job of removing that, but still, the structural, the path, the slash, and the dot. More importantly, I think the keyword is guessable because the keyword is a brand. So you've heard of these names because of advertising. You've heard of these names offline, and therefore you can guess a web address and you can type it, and usually you will get what you expected. So its guessability is clearly important. Memorability is another one. Once you've been to a web page, you cannot remember the URL. There is no way you can do that. A keyword, on the other hand, is something that you can keep in your mind. And there's actually a great analogy that compares keyword system to a very large bookmark system, except you would keep this bookmark in your head. Lastly, and it's very, very important, is that a keyword is more similar. DNS and URLs are limited to 7-bit ASCII and actually a few less characters, about 120 characters. Which means that you cannot have accents, you cannot have umlauts or Western languages, and you cannot have Asian languages with keywords. That's the opportunity. You can have all these languages. So for people like my mom, to be able to type in her English is clearly important. And you can imagine for Japanese or Korean people how important it is for those of them who don't speak English to be able to navigate in their own language. Now, that's also where the technology becomes interesting, is that a keyword is not unique. Okay, in DNS, the name is unique. A keyword is unique within a locale, which more or less corresponds to a country, which means that, for instance, the keyword BMW in the locale US English will go to bmwusa.com, which for a US English user is perfect. Now, in Germany, the same keyword will be mapped to bmw.de and will go to a German page, which means that it can address some of the conflicts of trademarks that are different in different countries. Yes. So that's the user perspective, a better, a more friendly, simpler web address. Now, as important is the value proposition for the customer. I mean, this is the situation today. If I'm Sony, I have one domain name, sony.com, and I have hundreds of products. And, you know, I have to disagree with the previous speaker. I don't think Sony wants to put these URLs on the back. And despite that, you know, Sony advertised Sony Station, Sony Walkman, Gattaca the movie, Sony Music, etc., etc. So how does Sony do that? Today they cannot do that. Next slide. Now, with keywords, I mean, the solution is obvious. They can have as many keywords as they have brands. And that's really the, you know, the important value proposition for Sony is that their brand, you know, this brand, they spend millions of marketing dollars advertising everywhere on radio, on TV, you know, on newspaper, now become their web address. So for them, they perceive the keyword system really as offline, you know, services because they can market offline and use their brand to drive traffic online, which they cannot do today. So it addresses, you know, fundamental limitations of the current web addresses. And of course, I had it also, they can advertise in the Kanji. So this slide here is trying to depict that it's really a natural evolution. Because if you think about it, DNS was really invented mainly at a time where the dominant protocol was the mail protocol, the SMTP. And if you think about it, person@sony.com makes a lot of sense. Now, when Tim Berners-Lee invented the web, you know, introduced a lot of components, but he does what good engineers do. He reuses what exists at that time. So he reuses DNS as a naming system. But my claim here is that DNS was not appropriate as a naming system for what has become now the dominant protocol, which is HTTP. And that a naming system is mostly appropriate to a specific protocol. And therefore, we need a new naming system. And I'm claiming that you need a human-friendly naming system that will be the dominant for the dominant protocol. So now I want to move into the difficult part for me because I guess we talked about that yesterday. Peter, I'm still a geek, and you know, the relationship between you know engineers and policy and politics and their ability to speak to it. So let's see what I can do here. What I want to describe here is what we've agreed upon in our company as guiding principles for policies. And it's actually fairly easy because we have one rule. You know, that's what Star Trek calls the prime directive. And the prime directive is that should not create a bad user experience. So in a sense, we've decided to privilege the user over the brand owner, over the trademark holder, although there's a lot of intersection. So because of that, keywords must be appropriate to the content, which means nobody can come and claim a keyword like I cannot come and purchase Microsoft because clearly my homepage is not appropriate. Microsoft can only get that keyword. The consequences are actually dramatic. That means we have to review what people subscribe and we have to reject people because of course they will try to get generic terms totally inappropriate or they will try to get somebody else's brand. And we have to hire a lot of people to actually do that work. But we believe that's the core value of that service, to be able to match user expectation. When a user types something, they should go to a place that they expect it. So we are driven by user expectation, not just trademark. So if you're on the web and you created your identity, you invested, you know, this is your business, this is your brand, and user expects to go there, and somebody, you know, who's in the offline work as a trademark, we will not give them that, we will not give them that keyword. For instance, we made decisions such as Apple as a keyword goes to Apple Computer because we believe that, you know, for the vast majority of internet users, when they type Apple, they expect to go to Apple Computer, not Apple Records. So that's a decision we've made. Now, we think in doing so, we address the two most common problems, the two most common pitfalls of DNS. The first one is IP robbery. Again, Microsoft can only get Microsoft. And second is cyber squatting. You cannot come and get a keyword and bring up a nice page that say, hey, I bought the keyword book and you know it's for sale. You cannot do that in our system because again, your content needs to be appropriate. And going back to your example of Fred's barbershop, you will give you your keyword if you are Fred and you know your webpage is about the barbershop. Now, the consequence of that is that we are going to make mistakes because this is not a science. I mean, there are humans involved. It's a very you know ambiguous decision. Some decisions are easy. Some you know some are difficult. So because of that, you know, we structure ourselves, we structure our term and condition in such a way we could make mistakes. That is, we have to the right to change our mind if we realize later down the road that we've made mistakes. So organization-wise, as I said, we have this internal namespace of 40 people that review, and then we have customers that disagree. And so we have to create a litigation process. So the first thing we did, we assembled what we call the policy advisory board that, you know, then includes people like Bill Washburn, who was from Stanford. We initiated the e-commerce six initiative a long time ago. People like Lori Fina from Trustee or Christine Varney from the head of the Department of Commerce, or people like Andrew Bridges that are one of the main attorneys from Wilson Sonsini in intellectual property. And so these people are still an internal board. They are basically the next step when there's a litigation where there's agreement between customers and our decision, and they can go to that board, and they're also the one that set the policy. One of the things we've asked that board to do for us is to create another board, if you want, a third level to escalate the litigation process. And we think that we need that board to be external to the company, because right now you have a lot of forces in action. On one hand, you have a business entity that's trying to make money and create revenue, what you would describe as the state. And on the other hand, you have this same entity making decisions that we could describe as church. So one of the goals of this entity is to agree on an external either process or an external bond, if you will, that would act as a Supreme Court. And it could be, that could be ICANN, that could be that they agree on a mechanism to find a mediator when two parties do not agree. What I want to emphasize here is that, again, because we have the names and the dispute will happen within a locale, within a language, we have the ability to distribute some of this litigation process. It doesn't have to be centralized. To summarize, I think that the main point is that DNS was not designed what it's used for today. The killer app of the web is web browsing, and DNS was not designed for that. And that's why we're witnessing all these problems. A new addressing system will emerge. This system will not replace DNS, it will hide it. In doing so, I think it will take a lot of the heat away from DNS. A lot of the issues that we discussed yesterday will become moot. You know, how many top-level domains do we need? Well, we will not need many. We've adopted the policy centered on the user. That's our decision. I'm not claiming that's the best decision, but I think it's one direction to observe. And the experiment, you know, in the marketplace is still going on. And my last point is that clearly building technology for me has been easier than talking about policies. Thank you.
Hi there. I'm supposed to play a different role here. I'm supposed to be a reactor. I'm supposed to react to what we've just heard. But I think first I'm going to augment the description of DNS that you heard just a little bit and give you some context to what else is happening in the internet world in some areas. Both Carl and Peter talked about the DNS and its hierarchical structure and all. So let me phrase the same thing they said slightly differently. We start at the root. The root is a database. It's a database of pointers to the next level down domains, the top level domain. And that's all it is a database of pointers. If you look at the next level down, it's a database of pointers. And this goes all the way down to, for example, Harvard University. Harvard University has a database of pointers that it runs. Not run by somebody else, it's run by Harvard. And that's actually one of the major strengths of the DNS, and its distributed nature, which Peter said noted that we need to have a distributed mechanism, is that the folks that are running the Harvard or maintaining the Harvard database, is Harvard the ones which are directly affected? Not somebody else, it's not some commercial company off someplace. It is Harvard that is maintaining its own little piece here. And if Harvard screws up, Harvard's the one that's affected. So there's incentive to deal with that. It's also distributed and can scale well because the individual organization is doing its own piece. You don't go off to a central registry to put in the information. And I think this is a this is a nuance on what both of them said, but I think it's an important nuance that you're distributing not only the data, but the responsibility for the data. So let's look at something else that's going on in the internet today. Carl mentioned IP telephony might be an interesting application in the near future. It certainly seems to attract a lot of attention. In the IETF, we've gone from a situation 2 years ago where the telephony world basically wasn't represented to that the largest single sector of representation of people at the last two IETFs have been from the telephony world. Matter of fact, 5 out of the top 7 companies at the last IETF were telephony companies. One of the things that we're looking at doing in the internet telephony thing is figuring out a technology by which you, sitting there on your internet telephone, can call somebody else knowing only a phone number. So you sit there and you type into your little laptop or your desktop machine somebody's phone number, area code in the whole nine yards. And that's got to get turned into an IP address either of the person you want to talk to or a gateway to the regular telephone system. We're going to need gateways for a little while yet since there are about 800 million telephones in the world. It's going to take a little while to move all of those to the internet. So how do you do that? How do you map the phone number into a IP address or the IP address of a gateway? And maybe even more, maybe it's the same phone number, but if you're trying to get to a fax machine, you're going to get a different resolution than if you're trying to get to voice. So how do you do that? And there's basically two ways that are being looked at. The internet way, the way that to follow Peter's model, distributed client server based, et cetera, be able to scale rapidly and identify a real need. Well, the real need is trying to get around the telephone companies, and that's certainly a real need, so we'll do that. But so the internet way to do that is let's get into DNS. Carl's with DNS is not just for IP addresses anymore. Well, it certainly isn't. I have this model that was done a few years ago called TPC.int, where you could basically look up a phone number in the DNS, and it would return to you an IP address. And that's a distributed model, so that individuals maintain their piece of that. It uses the same mechanism that's used for the reverse lookup of IP addresses. So you can look up somebody's IP address and get a domain name out of it. TPC.int could return an IP address, or it could return a domain name, which you then later could resolve into an IP address. A distributed model, and as with the IP address reverse lookup, it's distributed, but it's not distributed quite as cleanly as the forward looking. The forward domain name, harvard.edu, well, Harvard folks maintain their own little piece of that tree, and that little piece of the tree is identified by harvard.edu. On the reverse, it's a little harder because it's identified by what particular IP addresses and where in the structure they go. And the hierarchy of name servers which look at IP addresses is slightly different than the one that's looking at name, domain names. So that would be the case with phone numbers, too, that you'd have some kind of hierarchy of name servers run by ISPs, run by corporations, that would look at their particular piece of the reverse, the lookup, the phone numbers to domain names. So if you've got a corporation that has 10,000 phone numbers, then you would run your own little server that dealt with those 10,000. That's the internet way to do it. But that's not the telephony way to do it. And that's not the way that the telephony companies that are now coming to the IETF are thinking that it needs to be done. Their model is that these are services. Anything like this is a translation service. And you look for an example to the 800 number service. 800 numbers are portable in the U.S. The free phone stuff is portable in the U.S., 800, 888, et cetera, which means when you call a number, it has to go get translated into a real number. You have an 800 number that gets translated into a real number. And how do you do that? Well, the telephone companies have arranged a central set of servers that do that translation. The commercial venture that you hand this server a 800 number and it turns it into an actual phone number. And you pay some fee for doing that. This is the centralized database model, not a distributed model. not a client-server model, but a centralized database model. And that illustrates the kind of tension we're under here. Real names is an interesting piece of technology, but it's tending towards the centralized server model. It's not that's the wrong model. It doesn't fit Peter's definition of the kinds of internet design philosophies that you need to follow for successful deployment. So it'll be interesting to see that. I wanted to bring that into play because one of the things we're supposed to do at this session today is to worry about, do new technologies or redefine old technologies have a impact on the potential for different structures of, quote, governance? Do they permit different structures? In fact, can they live in different structures? And we'll see. I'm not sure the ones that we've talked about today really can, but I'll get back to those. Let's look at the individual presentations a little bit. Carl was talking about, you know, multiple routes and et cetera, et cetera, and that the different routes would sell their services. Well, one of the questions I have, and I think you can probably answer it when we get to there, is, well, what is the product they're selling and how are they selling it? Right now, if I go off and I try and resolve something, the root server is seen as part of the infrastructure that I'm not paying for. I'm not paying for it directly, I'm paying for it indirectly. But it's not something where I'm trying to be lured into using one and lured there by agreeing to read advertising or to give somebody some money. I'm not sure what you mean by marketing their services and who would be paying for what. And you mentioned somebody making a lot of money being a root server. I'm not a root director. I'm not really sure how that entails, so we need to clarify that a little bit. But that actually isn't a terribly important point to me because random high school kids could run the root servers, as Carl mentioned, they run on PCs. There's no real problem there. But I want to quote one of the things he said. He said, legitimate TLDs. That's a quote. And legitimate implies some definition, some decision process by some recognized authority. And if we claim legitimate TLDs is a requirement for that mechanism, then I'm not sure that we've changed the requirement for governance structure. We still need to have somebody who makes the determination of legitimacy. Peter made it a little bit easier in concept by adding the concept of an area code by removing the requirement for a determination that a top-level domain or some component in the hierarchy is legitimate or blessed in some way by saying, well, we just add this another layer of indirection on the top in a normal computer science solution to all problems. You add another little tidbit at the top someplace. And that's true, and that would work quite well. It's postulating a model of use that is, it's not the current use. That doesn't mean it couldn't be. But my issues on that particularly are what the user perceives. And Peter was heavily wanting to say that he's a user, or an abuser of the net, or something like that. And that he wants things that the users understand and that the users are driving. And yeah, everybody can run their own DNS and all of that, but the users get confused easily. We're talking about downloading something that resets your pointers to the root server. The corporations aren't going to really like that with different ones of their employees are pointing at different servers and getting different answers for the same question. But let's go to this adding another layer of indirection, adding a sequence number, which of course somebody has to assign, but that somebody can be almost anybody and of no particular governance question in there if it's a sequence number at the top level. You get away from using the DNS the way it's been used, which is a terrible way to use it, which is as a directory service. It's a terrible thing to have done is to get us into it's got us into this bind is that DNS is logical, at least in some definition of the word logical. A kind of a strained definition some of the time, but it is, quote, logical. It's rememberable. It's the stuff that you can stick on the side of a bus. And you don't generally put on the, and if you were talking about it, you don't generally put on the side of the bus a URL, you put in the key part of it, which is the www.foobar.com, and then you assume that the top level web page will direct you further than that. Sometimes that's a strained assumption. If you ever go into www.netscape.com and try and figure out where the hell you get the next version of Netscape, it's buried down in there someplace. I don't know what the hell they're trying to do, but they're not trying to sell product. So, in part of that, but what you put on this side of the bus, a.foobar.com or 523.foobar.com, it would work if people would remember that. And let's go back to the other another thing, which is, what do you put on your business card for your email address? This is a loaded question in that it's people have the assumption and the expectation that email addresses have meaning, that they're memorable, and that if you tell somebody, you can tell somebody your email address over the phone, and in some cases they don't have to write it down even. Scott_Bradner@harvard.edu is one of my two email addresses. The other one is sob@harvard.edu, but I've got to be a little careful where I use that one. And so that's memorable. But now if we stick a random number in the middle of it, it gets less memorable. Now it doesn't mean it don't work. We've got another thing on the business card, which is phone number. The likelihood of you just randomly remembering somebody's phone number is pretty low. I can't even translate the phone number on a business card to the phone without looking at it about three times. My short-term memory is not that great. I almost remember the 60s. But so if we get two people to change their paradigm of what they expect out of email addresses and other things like the stuff on the side of the bus, that would make a huge difference. It would get us out of a lot of the problem. But businesses still think that they're memorable. Businesses still think that part of that memorability is some character string that represents their product or their themselves. And as long as we have that, well, I think we're still going to have the, I don't think we get rid of any of the legalistic problems, whether there's an A or a 43 in the middle of it. If it says IBM in there, IBM trademark lawyers are going to be singing and dancing when somebody gets an IBM.foo that isn't them. Whether that's reasonable or not is irrelevant. They're going to be doing it, and don't be on the other side of their phalanx of lawyers at the wrong time. And then finally, the real name stuff. The real name stuff is actually very interesting and very nice. I like it. I think it's a good user-based thing, but I'm not sure what it does in the governance structure. I think actually all it does is reproduce the governance structure as a private company rather than as a supposedly independent organization. Real names is deciding who gets what keyword. They're deciding on the legitimacy or the let's see, the words they're using, there's a appropriateness is one of the words used, yes, and use whether the the thing I wanted to talk about was you're saying the expectation, the user's expectation. You use the example of Apple, that you believe that the users on the net expect that when they say Apple, they get Apple Computer rather than Apple Records or the Northeast Ontario Apple Growers Association. You expect that, and you make the assumption of that, and you have some mechanism by which you make that assumption. What happens if you're wrong? What happens if more particularly, what happens if the lawyer for the Northeast Ontario Apple Growers Association claims you're wrong? You as a private organization are not immune to somebody outside your organization not being real thrilled with your set of assumptions on what people would expect. But fundamentally, I think that you wind up making rules, you wind up making assumptions, you have appeals chains, and you wind up having an environment which, if you get more than about 4 feet away, looks like ICANN. So I don't think any of these things really change the structure, the requirements on the structure, except for one, which is Peter's random number, and that all we need to do is get humans to change. That's easy.
we have time for a couple of questions or comments? How about from the panel?
Well, Okay, since I went first, let me react to Scott's two questions about mine. With respect to legitimate PLDs, the word I tend to use is viable PLDs. That is measured in the mind of the person operating the root system. It is not an external metric. It is based on what the operator of the root system thinks he or she can sell. .com, .net, .edu. Standard PLDs are all viable offerings. They will take prime shelf space in everybody's root system. Ones that are disputed, for example, .web is a prime example, because it is subject to claims by two people, is one that the legitimacy or the viability will be measured in the mind of the person operating the root system, whether or not they want to carry it in their inventory. Now, what are the services that would differentiate between root and server systems? Why would a person pick one over the other? First point is, as far as the costs go, I assume those would all be absorbed by the operator and recovered by other means. Now, the differences are, and other means means you save money elsewhere or you can do something interesting. Now, some of the things you can do with this root system are, for example, communities of interest who want to have a filtered view of the internet landscape. This is people who self-censor themselves, for example, who don't want to see porn sites, could pick a root system that points to versions of the top-level domain servers that are exact copies of the standard top-level domain servers, except they've eliminated records in the DNS that point to sites which do not meet the criteria set up by the people who are subscribing to this site. Another possible service that would differentiate would be priority services. For example, if I'm a user of a financial service, or I may go to a root zone system that points me to extra servers, that point me to extra providers for a particular service. It's like when you register first class at the airline. You know, you have extra people who would take you at the gate, or when you come and get your ticket and take your bags. You can give priority services. Now, I'm not so sure that actual offering will work, but it's a possibility. Another one is what I mentioned, the proximity-based thing, where the operator of a net wants to cut down on the amount of long-distance DNS-based traffic. And DNS traffic is a significant portion of what's carried on the Internet today. The person operating the net can save money by cutting down on the traffic crossing their boundaries, especially in places like Australia and places where you pay dollars for packets. So if you take all of your users and point them to a root system that points to servers near your users, their queries won't flow as far. Now, I can point you to a PLD server that points to servers near the users using that server. I don't have to pick the exact PLD servers that other people use.
I'm talking about the data in the server. You're flipping back a little bit on this. Harvard's running its own server for Harvard.edu, which means if you want to resolve the naming in Harvard, you have to go to Harvard server to do that.
Do you run secondary?
Yeah, Columbia.
Okay, would you be open to someone running a secondary instead?
Make it worth our while to deal with the confusion.
And if I'm selling into using this, I have a little bit of money to spend. I'll come to you and say $4,000 a month, so I'd like to do a secondary yourself. No, Harvard's probably not the most popular of these.
Yeah, we don't have 36.
Well, you don't think so. I'd like to point out the very first.
We do have the security switch, actually. We want to see you put up a site where you sell for a saran wrap.
Exactly. The first two customers of Archie were Finland and Australia for exactly that reason. They shadowed the Archie database because of the traffic. They wanted to, if possible, to find things closer. And we ended up with 60 or 70 Archies around the world. Some of them never announced themselves in public. It was just to cut down on traffic. There are people that will pay this, and it will pay good money for it. If it delays the network upgrade by 6 months, I can tell you how much money that is. That's how much I'm willing to pay.
Okay.
the point I was, the last point, though, is we don't want to limit to say that because we can't think of a money-making way to use that, that there isn't a money-making way to use this sort of thing.
Rico, you had a reaction?
The first one that was about the centralized model. I wanted to say that Boston technology and actually this is distributed, but more importantly from a logical standpoint, although it looks from the outside of a flatman space, as I explained, it's hierarchical. Well, first it can be structured in terms of what's happening. So you could actually have root servers, as we call it, in German for main developer German. Now, we also reinvented, if you want, that notion of top-level domain in our system for the critics. So, for instance, we could give Harvard the critics Harvard. And then Harvard could assign keywords in their critics. So, Harvard books would go somewhere that Harvard is cited. And because we think that critics are actually doing critics. And as a matter of fact, we actually talk critics to companies like eBay. So, you can type eBay, Turnybase, Turnybase, and you will actually do critics on eBay. That. They will show you all the options from here. Another example is Amazon, Harry Potter. Because again, in Amazon will be connected with the Harry Potter book system by content. So the idea here is that although it's a flat namespace from the outside, that string can be structured using that notion of prefix, and that prefix allows a distribution. At least a hierarchy, to create a hierarchy that will allow that kind of system.
So that's the same criteria for deciding on prefixes.
Exactly. You get the prefix.
So yes, Harvard would be Harvard or Harvard Machinery Company.
In that case, we would probably have a university. Now, you ask, what happens when we're wrong? As I said, terms and conditions would structure these terms so that we could be wrong because we have the right to change our mind. If a famous movie comes out with a title and everybody expects it, when they check the movie title, if you look at the page that talks about that movie, then we'll probably have to change that too, or even for your friends, somebody else prior to that.
That's what happens through the investment that the other
companies made in their career. So, it's a blurry line, and that leads me to a point where you talked about user expectation and user awareness. We think that one way to create awareness is how you will brand your keywords. Because there are keywords that are ambiguous by nature. But the journey comes for instance are a really good example. Who would deserve the keyword book, for instance? Well, our solution is to make books a very costly quote unquote keyword for the person who wants that keyword. And it would be costly because there is no user expectation when somebody types books in their browser. We would require them to advertise everywhere that they are, the book people, and they're meant to be known under that keyword. And it's very costly for them because they would have to invest a lot of marketing dollars under that brand. So people like Amazon or Barnes & Noble, they don't want the book keyword because they already branded under Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Okay, in the interest of having some floor discussion and getting some questions and comments,
I thought they were very important points.
Let's have the first speaker at the phone, and please identify yourself.
Out of the phone. That's it. Paul Garrett from Namespace. First, I want to thank Scott for bringing a little reality check to the discussion. I think your points are very clear and well articulated. Carl, your idea about multiple routes in essence is a good one in that it's distributing load and including performance, but some of the points that you raised, for example, filtering and ISP choosing which TLDs would be appropriate for the client, I think is really misplaced. especially because I don't believe that it's the role of the domain name servers or the operators to be censored.
I don't care if the service is simply defined.
Right, but I think if people would like to filter, they should do that at their own computers and don't let that happen somewhere.
There's a way of doing it.
There are probably many ways to do it, but I don't think that that's a workable model. And also, right, okay. I'm just giving you feedback on what I...
You know, for example, people can avoid a $1 domain name fee or tax or avoid a dispute resolution policy.
That aspect, I think, is very good. I think that some of the elements of your theory there are interesting, but where I believe it falls apart is the fragmentation issue or the inconsistency issue, because what makes the internet great is interoperability. And
if I send you http://k there, you're not going to be able to get there. It's a non-fully qualified domain name. We already have fragmentation. We also have things behind firewalls, and I can send you a URL you cannot reach.
Well, that's true, but that's not the main point what you were talking about.
But it's fragmentation.
Right, if you want to really get into the semantics. But in terms of transparent interoperability of a coherent distributed route, it's possible to decentralize the route, and it's possible to also keep it synchronized and coherent.
And 5 years ago, people were giving around email addresses, and a lot of people had telephones and couldn't reach email. People started getting on email, and we lost that fragmentation.
I think you've made your point, and I think Carl has responded to it as well as you're going to get it. Anyway, Gene?
Gene Camp, and I have two separate points to make. One to Carl and Peter. The difference between economics and what some would call the hard sciences is that in the hard sciences, when something fails over and over and over again, that theory is proving false. Now, you have advocated the creation of subnetworks and that fragmentation is okay. Well, MSN tried that, and AOL tried that, and you're trying that, and it's failing spectacularly well. And think it'll continue to fail in terms of your ability to truly reach most of the users on the Internet. But I must admit, I'm not unfamiliar with your theological embrace of the flawless governance of the market, and I admire your ability to keep up, maintain optimism in the face of data.
Well, the issue here is every time we try to get it again, we do it with 4 times as many users. So if I come up with a killer app in the next 6 months to a year, I have 150
Yeah, it might yet not fail. I might, you know, all past history may be wrong and it might not fail and it might work and keep trying and good luck. And to Rick, I think the important thing to distinguish here is the difference between government and governance. Governance is making fundamental decisions, like when Exxon comes into a town to start oil, you know, how much pollution control do they put on there? It's Exxon's decision, it's still market governance. Now, the real main concept of governance, particularly since it is bundled with the browser, which is bundled with the operating system, is this kind of, the Christian Coalition says, we believe in your right to make choices. We believe in your right to make the right choice. So you're making the right choice for everyone. And I'd like to point out that you have not resolved any of the questions which I brought forward in my presentation. The consent of the governed, well, you're with Microsoft. It's a monopoly. How are you going to get the consent of the governed? You say, we have the right to change our minds. Do people have the right to change their minds? The fundamental premise of democracy is that people have the right to be wrong. So even if you were lawless in your decision making, the fact that you have made what should be a transparent process completely controlled and internal, even if you were always right, would still mean what you're doing is governance. What you're doing is the ultimate closed door ICANN, and what you're doing is fundamentally wrong, but I respect that you do have market power, and the fact that you can do it does not make it a righteous choice.
And so I have a question back to you. What if you modified the service so that you logged into it and told the real name service who you were, and it remembered preferences about how you like to have your names resolved?
Well, nobody's stopping that from happening now. But the thing is, one of the things where solutions advocate is a tremendous activism on the part of the user. And because of the piece, that makes sense, because you really like to do this. Well, for neurosurgeons and cab drivers who just want it to work, it's true that all of this would work in theory, given infinite attention spans, so that consumers and individuals can put a huge amount of time into choices and education.
Okay,
Gents, we're really running into the, we've already run into the break, so I'd like to get at least one or two more, if we could just one or two more speakers to come forward.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that. I mean, I just want to point out something, you know. We think we made a very hard decision. We could have gone for first come, first serve. It would have been easy. Look, we're burning all that money. We're hiring a lot of people, 40 people for a small company just to do that because, you know, somebody has to do it. You know, we would be very happy if somebody else wanted to do it. We just, you know, I think we had the guts to do it. And now we understand that in the long run, we cannot be the stake in the church, as I was saying. And we're trying to structure ourselves to eventually respond to an external board that can make the ultimate decision. And that's why we're not trying to do it behind closed doors. But point number one, it's not easy to do, and, you know, DNS, in the DNS world, nobody has tried to do that. We thought it was important for the user, and, you know, we stand by that, and we think it's very brave, especially from an economic standpoint, that's point number one. And number two, we're trying to as you've seen, to have a litigation process so they can be, you know, the voice of the people, you would say. People can not only participate in that process, but ultimately, if there are conflicts, you know, 99% is easy. But there's that 1% where you need to have a litigation process, and we cannot, and we will not make the ultimate decision. Now the point is, which body will have that power? We don't know. All we're saying is, at the end of the day, we don't want to have that power. We do not want to have that power.
Okay.
My name is Hans Klein, and I'm a little concerned about schedule, so I guess at 10:30 we'll probably stop if we can move on. My question is, what do I take away from this panel? Is the bottom line that I don't have to worry about ICANN? Is that it? That it's really not a problem? Because it sounds like Carl's saying, oh, we'll just root around it. It's a door in a field. Don't worry about it. Just go around the door. It sounds like Nico's saying, DNS, in a little while will be history. We've got an alternate approach. Maybe, Peter, I guess what you're saying, to get the numbers approach, maybe you get a little tangled up with ICANN. But is the question, but just don't worry about ICANN.
Well, I'm going to sort of take the opportunity to also respond to Gene's point and merge the two together. Yes, maybe Microsoft tried to run something that looked a little bit like this a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, there weren't how many million entries under .com. When I tried to register a personal domain name for myself in May, I tried 5, 6, 7 times. My name, my wife's name, my mother's maiden name, the country I was born in, the town I was born in, the ancestral castle that my mother's grandfather was born in, and they were all gone. What we've reached now in the current system is we're running out of names, but is it a real scarcity or not? If it's a real scarcity, we're going to need a governance structure to resolve debates. And I guess Carl and I have a view that it's not a real scarcity. And now there's a new need. The next 150 million people also want Deutsch.com. They also want Avalon.com. They also want Dunvegan.com. These are all names that you can't have anymore. And at some point, we have to figure out a way to address this need, or the next person who addresses it will. And what will happen is some killer app will come out that also has this thing as a feature, and it's going to be deployed. Domo 11 is going to happen in the next 2 years. If it doesn't, I'm wrong, and I'll have wasted my own money, or somebody will have wasted their own money trying to find it out. But the issue here is, it's like governance is necessary, but not necessarily governance. There's some coordinating things, which if people coordinate, will go more smoothly. But it's one of those, and if they don't get done, does the net stop tomorrow? No. And you know, the only issue I see with all of this is, you're trying to anticipate things in the future that may never happen. You're building huge structures for things that may not happen. And I just, in my experience, in this environment, with things moving so fast and technological change happening overnight, I think we're over-engineering problems with this. That's my feeling. And I may be wrong, but there's no evidence that I'm confronting that says this all grinds to a halt in 3 months if we've got it wrong. I may just be a Pollyanna, but yeah, it's not as big of a problem as you think of it.
I'd ask, like all ICANN is divided in three parts, and we still need ICANN over IP address as an absolute minimum.
Yeah, I guess my conclusion was that I can, for the same reason, that was, it's still needed. Now, I think that the problems that I can going to solve are basically, some of them are going to disappear because of that emerging layer, if you will. Or maybe some of the problems will be controlled if indeed, you know, there is only one layer that emerges in that new structure, which right now is not the case. So, I don't want to say, I guess the main point was that the problem within 1 year is going to be fairly different. So the issue that I can deal with are somewhat, some of the points I'm dealing with are going to be.
I would say that you got a piece that turned it on over there. I think that there is a nuance here that you might want to entertain. So we're talking about an icon or the icon. The ICANN or an ICANN. And somebody that, some organization, some structure to make some decision point. IP addresses, as Carl points out, absolutely. But there is the legitimate or viable or whatever it is, top-level domains. There's arguments between folks who both claim a particular top-level domain in the multi-root environment, which has to be adjudicated somehow. There have to be, somebody's got to have that pointer. Somebody's got to, who's got to decide that there is a pointer to a .com, or there is a unique unique .web. Without that, then one of Peter's main things is it is broken from the user's point of view if things look differently when they try to do things differently. And a lot of this problem would be made much simpler if the world were different. If indeed people didn't expect context to their email addresses, and they were happy to put in a random digit in the middle of the domain name, it would fix a lot of problems. It doesn't fix them all. It doesn't fix the fact that trademark lawyers are more aggressive than God, but it would help. It would help some things. I don't think the point of this discussion. I don't think is no, there doesn't need to be an ICANN. The point of this discussion, I think, is that some of the decisions might be easier, but there still needs to be some group to make that those decisions to be tested that weren't the FTC.
Okay, one more person, please.
With respect to the multiple root system, if there's a dispute over a TLB, it's the choice of the root system operators how to resolve that dispute. They will simply pick the one they choose, and likely they will not pick one that is disputed.
Okay, one more point. Well, it takes both sides to be short.
Okay. My name is Eric Mingia with the United States Small Business Administration. I thank you guys for the presentation on Sunday. It's given me a lot of food, thought, things to think about. However, I'm very concerned about the alternatives you proposed and what that impact would be upon small business as they're entering onto the Internet. I'm particularly concerned that regardless of what you put after the dot, whether it be dot MPEG or dot web, as long as you have a string of characters in there that resembles a trademark, you're still going to have the issues of trademark rights. And small businesses are always going to be bumping into that. Also, I was also concerned of who, my question to this panel is, who has the authority to oversee additional root servers or just adding to the additional string in the URL? Would it be ICANN? Would it be Department of Commerce? Would it be neither? What would be the political realities of this? As we're adding more and more people to the Internet, we're also adding more and more people to have websites registered, and you're accruing interest there. It'll be harder and harder to move as time goes on.
And who would like to take a shot at that one, and we'll see if we can't still get these last gentlemen in just waiting on.
The simple answer is it's business. And it's both Carl and Real and Mitch all talking about business solutions. This is a marketplace solution. If there are multiple routes, there are businesses. And there isn't a governance in that model. There isn't a governance. And in the adding another digit string in the middle, that's also a business thing. It's not that you need to do this by somebody on high dictating this is the way to do it. I agree with you that this is fuzzy stuff, and it would not make me, who is trying to make a big investment on the web, real happy. But both as the people on the panel, other than me, who is not involved in it, are saying that if the models they're proposing are wrong, they will fail. The models will fail, and the net as it is now will keep going. It keeps working. The DNS is down there. Under real names, the DNS is there. It doesn't change.
Just to clarify,
understand the question. You were talking about who adds TLDs to the current route or who adds new routes?
Who would add new routes?
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So they would just have to have some changes into the underlying technology.
Okay. There's no changes to the technology whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And what will happen, I predict, because this has happened time and time again with technology, approximately 80 to 90% of the market will go to the dominant player who wins. 10% will go to the next lower player because the 10% of the people always hate the dominant player. And everybody else gets table scraps. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking CPUs, Intel and the rest, or whether you're talking OSs, Microsoft and the rest, or you're talking Office Suites, which is now Microsoft Office, or whatever. That's what happens. So that's why Carl and I look at this and say, a bunch of people, you know, let 1,000 routes bloom, one of them will get 90% of the traffic or 80% of the traffic, one will get 10% of the traffic, and there'll be a bunch of specialty boutiques out there. Now the issue is whether you have to dictate it and the FCC decides who gets to do it. And I look at this and say, even if you guys wanted to stop it, I don't see how you're going to do it. Tell me how you're going to stop it. It's going to happen. It's happening now.
If there are multiple routes out there, I have not used the ICANN legacy route system for quite a long time. I've operated my own route system. I've used a couple of alternative route systems. I've never had this connectivity. I subjected myself to this first to make sure that it worked before I would advocate it.
Okay, could we give this last gentleman a chance, please?
Peter and Carl, you both know that I'm not happy with your system, your ideas.
Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm Craig Simon, University of Miami, School of International Studies. But perhaps I should be happy because when I'm not an academic studying the way internet engineers do social engineering, I am employed helping users. And if the system is complexified because of the new layers of indirection, multiple routes and zones, prefixes and so on, I'll have more to do. But perhaps I should be thanking you. So, Peter, give me a head start and let me know what an email address would look like using one of these zone areas.
It would look like peterdeutsch@514:black, whatever you've got now. That would work. That can be resolved today.
Okay, well.
One point you... Yeah. Well, actually, that's actually one of the things we're trying to do here is remove this whole debate about who gets to make the choices, right?
If it's just a number, then you don't care what number you have other than, you know, 666 or something like that. Or 212 if you happen to try to live in New York. Mostly it's semantics free.
I would also point out, you look at this and you say it's getting more and more complex. Oh, I was on the URL working group. We did say at the time we didn't intend for the long term humans to be looking at these things. Several years later, humans are still looking at them. But the issue for me is what's going to make any of this stuff work is the next 150 million people are going to find some killer app, probably related to e-commerce, it's just my guess, which will have content they want. And they'll reach it through this killer app, and they won't be typing most of these things in. They're going to be doing the kind of things he's suggesting. They're going to be using pull-down menus. They're going to be going through web pages as they do now. And the only distinction is we're going to offer them a little bit more choice than we have today. Today, I can't go out and say something about products, something about services. I want to do that. No one's letting me do it, so I'm going to go give somebody some money so I can do it. And it'll go into a client, or it'll go into a web page, and then people will be able to use it. Most of the time, you don't type. Most URLs go through DNS aren't being typed in. They're being referenced through pages, or you're replying to email that came to you. And if I can't make that work, no one can give me the money.
Maybe we can have 5 minutes of a break here where you can carry on the discussion over a cup of coffee, but please join me in thanking the group for a very provocative session.